We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good day. Okay, it's a pleasure once again. I think this is the third year in a row that Rabbi Helfgott is here for our Yom Iyun on Tanakh, sort of, which he has sort of been running for 5 years now?
Seven years,
uh-oh. In New York, YCT, the rabbinical school where he teaches at Chovevei Torah, where Rabbi Helfgott is the chair of the department of Tanakh and Jewish thought. So here you hear his ideas on Tanakh. Some of his ideas on Jewish thought are in here. It's really a collection of the letters of the Rav. He was chosen like by the family to edit the letters of Rabbi Soloveitchik I mentioned earlier. If you don't have the book, we have a few copies left. You're not many. It's really a fascinating book on the personal letters of Rav Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Helfgott works extremely tirelessly on behalf of Klal Yisrael. He is really doing wonderful work in New York and beyond, and the connection Israel and a student of Rav Lichtenstein and the Chaim Leibowitz, and really it's a pleasure to have him on a professional level, on a personal level, and it's nice he brought his son here, him and his wife, four boys, and right after his talk, he's heading back for a flight to New York, so we'll all wish him well, and we'll hope to see you again next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. It's always a pleasure to be here, very dear friend. And as I said in my other talk, Torah in Motion is an amazing organization, and I hope everyone can support it in every way that they can, whether it's financial, whether it's giving chizuk, whether it's giving political support, whatever way, showing up with programs, whatever way you can. Is there anyone who doesn't have a handout? If you don't, please come up. Unfortunately, ran out of staples, so take one and then another one. One and two. Okay. Sorry, ran out of staples. It's an economic downturn in America. Yeah.
It's the last page.
No, it's okay. Okay, the last page. So this topic that we're talking about today, I spoke about it 2 years ago. This is not a straight Tanakh shir as opposed to the other talk. This is a more of an about it topic rather than it topic. But it's a very important topic. It's one that sometimes is a dividing line between different kinds of committed Jews, different kinds of observant Jews, but it's one that is very well attested to in the traditional sources. And as I said in the heading, the topic that I'm looking at is traditional sources, meaning I'm not going to examine the consonantal text of the Torah from the scholarly point of view within the world outside of orthodoxy. I want to look at from within our own tradition. Many of the assumptions that we sometimes make are actually incorrect. And it's important to be honest, and it's important to be truthful. And so that's what I'd like to talk about today. I guess if I was in an academic context, this would be a talk on lower biblical criticism as opposed to higher biblical criticism. The difference is lower biblical criticism focuses on the text, the received text of the Torah. Is the text that we have in front of us today the exact same text that the authors, or author, depending on your theological perspective, came to? There's a very famous quip of Professor Shalom Rosenberg. Professor Shalom Rosenberg said that the difference between classical biblical criticism and Franz Rosenzweig and Rav Breuer's approach to Tanakh was that the classical biblical critics believed that there was an R, there was a redactor, who put together J, E, P, and D, right? The different sources that they believe are the source of the Torah. Rosenzweig believed that the R was Moshe Rabbeinu, that it was J, E, P, and D that put together. It was Moshe Rabbeinu that put together these various sources. And Rav Breuer believes that it was R was the Ribbono Shel Olam, that it was the Ribbono Shel Olam himself who put together these various divine documents, different perspectives on the truth, and brought them together into the Torah that we know and love that was given at Sinai. So we're not talking about that today. We are, whatever your assumption, and I assume the Torah is Min HaShemayim, the Torah is divine, whatever your assumption is, wherever you believe the Torah was given at some point in history or put together, the question is, at that point in history, is the text that we have in front of us today the exact same text for traditional Jews? Is that the same text that Moshe Rabbeinu, at the end of the 40 years, either collected together, Torah, Megillah, Megillah, Nitna, which according to the Gemara in Gittin, means that the Torah was written over the course of 40 years, serially, with an S, not a C, okay? It was written over the course of 40 years, or Torah Chatumah Nitna, the Torah was written in one shot at the end of 40 years. Remember, it's very important to remember, there is no one in the tradition who believes that the entire Torah scroll that we have in our Aron Kodesh was given at Sinai. No one believes that. Okay? Even though many little kids may believe that. There is no one in the tradition who believes that the Torah scroll, as it's written, was given at the moment of Sinai. It doesn't say that in the Torah. The Torah says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Luchot. It says Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Sefer HaBrit in chapter 24 of the book of Exodus, Sefer HaBrit. But the actual writing of the entire Torah scroll from Bereshit to Le'enei Kol Yisrael, the end of the Torah, was either written over the course of the 40 years, Torah Megillah Megillah Nitna, and then put together at the end, or it was written at one time at the end of the 40 years, Torah Chatumah Nitna. There is nobody, so remember that. There's one thing you remember from this year. Nobody believes that the Torah scroll that we take out of the Ark every Shabbat was actually given at Sinai. The Luchot were given at Sinai. Maybe some other parts of the Torah, but not the entire scroll. So that's point one. So what we're talking about is the text that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote at the end of the 40 years, and maybe added to by Yehoshua, the last 8 Pesukim, the last 12 Pesukim, according to one opinion, is that the same text that Jews take out in the synagogue on Shabbat? So the truth is, the Torah itself is pretty silent about that. The Torah is not so self-referential. It doesn't ask questions like, you know, who authored this part of the Torah and who authored that part of the Torah? It doesn't ask questions of whether every single letter, jot and tittle that we have in front of us is exactly the same that Moshe. The Torah, it just doesn't ask that question. That's a stepping back question that we ask, or that Chazal, the rabbis, ask. But that's not the question the Torah addresses. And Tanakh itself is very, very silent. Here and there, the Torah, Tanakh mentions things like Zichru Torat Moshe Avdi. Remember the Torah of Moshe. But that's a very ambiguous phrase. Zichru Torat Moshe. What does that mean? Does it mean remember the entire Torah from Breshit Elei Kol Yisrael? Or does it refer to the corpus of the laws that we call, that are in the Torah? The Tanakh never explicitly tells us who wrote every single line and who wrote every single word. But the rabbis, of course, did get involved in that. The rabbis were forced here and there to examine questions related to the origin of the Torah, especially when they came into conflict with other approaches, whether they were Jewish sectarians or Hebrew Christians or others. And Chazal, from time to time, had to formulate beliefs, doxologies. Now, of course, it wasn't as elaborate as the Rambam's Animamins. So that's just not the way in the ancient world people did things. But we do have a very famous Mishnah, which is a very ambiguous Mishnah. If you look at source 1, Mishnah in Sanhedrin says, Kol Yisrael yesh lam chelek olam haba, all Jews have a portion in the world to come. Shenemar ve'amech kulam tzadikim lo'olam yirshu aretz, netzer mata'ay ma'aseh yaday lehitpa'er. So all Jews have a portion in the world to come. We like that. That's the good part. That's the part that makes us you know, feel all warm and fuzzy, because we're very embracing of all Jews, whether you eat a ham sandwich on Yom Kippur or you don't eat a ham sandwich on Yom Kippur. You're all part of, you all have beatitude, you all reach heaven on some level. Some people have a bigger portion, some have, look, fine. These are the Jews that don't have a portion in the world to come, which sounds like very serious business. And there are three people mentioned. Ha'omer ein tchiyat ha-meitim min ha-Torah. Someone who says there is no tchiyat ha-meitim from the Torah. What happens if you say there is no tchiyat? There is tchiyat ha-meitim, but it's not from the Torah. Interesting question. Let's say you believe that it's not in the Torah, but you believe in Mishnah's ambiguous. Or you say ein Torah min ha-shamayim. You say that the law is not from heaven, and an apikores. Very ambiguous phrases. I'm not interested in the first one. I'm not interested in the third one. I'm interested in the middle one. What does the phrase ein Torah min ha-shamayim mean? Again, super ambiguous. What does the phrase Torah mean in rabbinic language? The word Torah, if you open up your Bar Ilan computer program and put in Torah, you will find the word Torah means 20 different things in Midrash and in Chazal. Does Torah mean very narrowly the Aseret HaDibrot? Or maybe, does Torah mean the five books of Moses? Does Torah mean all of Tanakh? It's unclear. The Mishnah is unclear. Very often in rabbinic language, it's unclear what the original meaning of the Mishnah is. And what does it mean, min ha-shamayim? Does it mean that you have to, someone who says it, do you have to believe that it's directly communicated by God, peh el peh? Does it mean through a prophet? Divine inspiration? I mean, all these interesting questions are left open in the Mishnah. They're not explicit in the Mishnah. If you want to be honest, they're not explicit what you have to believe or not have to believe. What you can't believe is somehow something which is called Torah is not divine in origin. The Talmud tries to make it a little clearer. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, in the middle source. The Talmud, which I'm looking at, the Tanya Idach, which is the one that became the dominant reading within the Rishonim, within the medieval commentaries. Tanya Idach, Kidvar Hashem Baza. Zeha Omer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. This is a Jew who says the Torah is not from heaven. What does that mean? Va'afilu Amar Kol HaTorah Kula Min HaShemayim. Chutz mi pasuk zeh. Even if you say the entire Torah is from heaven, except for this verse, Shelo amaro hakadosh baruch hu elo Moshe mi pi atzmo, zehu kidvar Hashem baza. So if someone says the entire Torah is from heaven, except for one verse that God didn't say, but Moshe made it up himself, that's problematic. Let me ask you a middle case. What happens if someone says the entire Torah is from heaven? These psukim are not from Moshe, but they're from some other prophet, from God. What would you paskin on them based on this braita, on this statement? Again, the braita is ambiguous. The braita says, presents a stark choice. Torah min ha-shamayim or Moshe mipi atzmo amaran. It's either divine from God, or Moses made it up himself. What about a middle situation? What happens if you believe the Torah is from heaven, but not everything is from Moses? Again, an unclarity in the Talmud and in the Gemara. And what exactly is Torah? Does Torah mean all five books of Moses? Or does it mean the core laws of Moses? Or does it mean the four books, but Dvarim is different? Because it says, Ela ha-dvarim asher. What's the first verse? Asher diber Moshe. It sounds like Deuteronomy is a little different than the rest of the Torah. Meaning, there's a lot of ambiguity if we come to the text without any preconceptions of what the Abarbanel says and what Rav Moshe says and what everybody... But if you look at the text in a kind of step-back fashion, there's a lot of ambiguity. What did Chazal really mean? And I'm not sure what Chazal really meant. And the truth is, for most of us, it doesn't really matter either, because we don't live just alpi the Tanakh, and we don't live just alpi Chazal. We live through the prism of how it was then interpreted by subsequent generations, whether we like it or we don't like it. And if we have to confront the question of the text of the Torah, we have to see how subsequent generations approached it. And what did they mean and what did they not mean? So I'd like to look with you today at the question, because again, if you just stop with the Talmud, notice the Talmud does not say anything that one has to believe that every single word that we have today is exactly the same as Moses. The Talmud doesn't address that question. The Talmud addresses the question of the origin of the Bible. Let me flesh it out a little bit what I mean. Let's say I am a super duper from Jew, and I believe that every single word of the Torah was given by God to Moses at Sinai. I believe that. I believe Torah min Hashemayim. But I also believe that in the course of history, things got messed up. What happens if I believe that? What happens if I believe that as scribes started writing things down, they made mistakes, and they copied things incorrectly, and there were pogroms and dislocation, and things got messed up? What happens then? I affirm that at one time in history, there was a pristine act of Torah min Hashamayim. From heaven, God gave the Torah. But when it came into this very fragile world of the vicissitudes of life, the pull and the strum and darn of life, then things got messed up. What about that? So the issue revolves around the interpretation of the famous comment of Maimonides. Maimonides, at the bottom of the page, Maimonides in the famous doxology, his presentation of Jewish belief, the first formal presentation of what a Jew has to believe, and others disagreed with the Rambam. The Rambam in the eighth principle, Hayesod HaShmini, in the Perush HaMishnayot to this Mishnah says, Hu Torah min HaShemayim. Just parenthetically, I just want to show you, in the Rambam, he never uses the phrase Torah mi Sinai. It's always Torah min HaShemayim. Hu Shina Amin, Shekol HaTorah Hazu HaNimtzeit Biyadeinu Hayom, Hi HaTorah Shenitna LeMoshe, V'Shehi Kula Mipi HaGvura. So notice Maimonides did a wonderful move. While in the Talmud says nothing about the consonantal text of the Bible as being exactly the same, the Talmud totally focuses on the issue of, is this Moses' creation, a la Spinoza, or is this God's creation, Torah min HaShamayim, or Moshe mipi atzmo? That's the dichotomy in the Talmud. Maimonides introduces into the Jewish discussion, in addition to believing that the Torah is kula mipi agvura, that the Torah is totally from heaven, you also, as part of that belief, you must also believe that the text that we have today, sitting in Egypt in 12 whatever, that the Rambam is sitting in, is exactly the same text that Moshe Rabbeinu had. The Rambam is the one who really put on the map this kind of, I don't know what term, I don't want to give it a bad term or a good term, a new reading of the Talmud in Sanhedrin. He's the one who introduces into Jewish theology the belief that every single word is exactly the same as the one that Moshe received. And the question is, can the Rambam's words actually be sustained? And was it actually accepted by Chazal and by the Rishonim? And is the Rambam really being serious when he says that? Usually we think the Rambam is a very serious person. The question is, did he literally mean that? Or is he using hyperbole? Because the Rambam was a very smart guy. And he knew all the sources that I'm going to quote today. And I don't believe the Rambam for a minute didn't know the sources. And so we are confronted with a reality that the Rambam makes a very far-reaching, bombastic statement, that it becomes a kind of card-carrying, if you stop a little kid on the street, psokli psukecha, a little kid in day school, they all know this, right?
that the Torah that we have today is exactly the same Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu said. And the reason they know it, they don't know because the Rambam said it, they know because they think that's what the Torah says. And the Torah never says it. So the truth is that this contention of the Rambam, taken literally, is simply impossible to maintain, simply false, and simply anti-Jewish. Not anti-Jewish, that's a little strong. Not like anti-Jewish like, you know, York University. It's anti-Jewish like... it's anti-Jewish in the sense that it just goes against all our sources. Let's look at a few sources. I could multiply the sources we're looking at by 10, but I'm not because I have to catch a flight, as Rabbi Kelmy said. So the sources. First, Gemara. Gemara, the Bavli. On page 2, the Bavli. In Kiddushin Daf Lamed, in the Talmud Bavli, page 30, the Talmud has a very wonderful digression about why the Jews, why were the early rabbis called Sofrim? Why were the early rabbis called scribes? So the Talmud says they were called Sofrim, Shayu Sofrim Kola Otiyot Sheba Torah. They were the rabbis who counted all the words of the Torah. Shayu Omrim Vav De Gichon Chetzian Shel Otiyot Shel Sefer Torah. Darosh Darash Chetzian Shel Tevot. They counted up and they gave little signs and little mnemonic devices to remember that the vav of the word gichon, is the middle of the Torah, and the word darash, darash is the middle of the word, the letters, and the word darosh, darash, when Moshe Rabbeinu tries to find out what happened to the korban after Nadav and Avihu were killed, died, is the middle of words. And the Talmud then asks a question. Look at line 4. By Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef and Amora, we're talking about maybe 4th century Babylon. Vav de Gichon mehai gisa o mehai gisa. Is the vav of the word Gichon in the Sefer Torah? Gachon, excuse me. Thank you very much. I'm thinking So, is the vav of Gachon... is it in the first half of the Torah or the second half of the Torah? So what's the obvious answer? What do you mean the middle? But I mean, what's the assumption of the question? It's an even number. There's an even number of letters in the Torah. So it has to be on one side or the other. So the Talmud gives the obvious statement. Amar le nesi sefer Torah v'imninu. Open up a sefer Torah and let's count it. I mean, what... this is an empirical question. Go to Surah, go to Pumpadita, go to the yeshiva, and count. Says the Gemara, Milo Amar Rava Barachana Lo Zazu Mishamat Shevi Sefer Torah Menom. Don't we have examples where the Gemara, you know, wanted to figure out something and opened up a Sefer Torah? Amar Le, so the Gemara says, no. That was in Eretz Yisrael. Inhu Biki B'chaserot V'yeterot. Anan Lo Biki Inan. In Eretz Yisrael, they have very good Sifrei Torah. But here in Bavel, the Sifrei Torah we use are different. And they're not so kosher, they're not so good. And the Gemara goes on in this way, saying, and gives a list of other things. So the Gemara already in Bavel knew that the Sifrei Torah that they used, and they made brachas on, and they danced with on Simchas Torah, and they did all the things, were different than the... we're different in small ways. I always make the joke. I don't want to make this like in one Sefer Torah it said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Another Torah it said, Shema Yisrael, Hare Krishna, Hashem Echad. I mean, it doesn't say that. But in little differences between Vav and other things, it was different. And if you look later on in the Gemara says, how many psukim are there in the Torah? Tanu Rabbanan. Chameshet alafim ushmona meot ushmonim ushmona psukim havi psuke sefer Torah. There are 5,888 psukim in the Torah. Now look at Rabbi's side. Kefi hacheshbon hanimsar b'chol hachumashim ole psukei Torah chameshet alafim 845. He says, Rabbi's side, writing in the 1600s, says that if you go and take the Sifrei Torah in Krakow, and the Sifrei Torah in Aleppo, whatever, you'll see it's a different number. The way the Psukim are organized are different. So clearly, Sifrei Torah throughout history were slightly different. And that's the truth. And if you want to see the truth, again, take a look at the Masechet Sofrim, a Gaonic work, a very famous Masechet Sofrim. On the left-hand side, Masechet Sofrim writes, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Levi, sorry, got cut out. Shlosha Sfarim nimtzu ba'azara. There were three books that were found in the Azara when they came back from the exile. Three Sifrei Torah. I need my math whizzes to help us here, but it's not so difficult math. One they called Sefer Me'ona, one they called Sefer Zatute, and another they called Sefer Baham. Matsu Katuv Ma'on, Ubishnaim Katuv Me'ona. What happened? In one Sefer Torah, they had three books in the Azara, in the Beit HaMikdash. In one of them, it was written the word Me'ona, and in the other two, it was written the word Ma'on. So which one is right? How do you determine which one is right?
Majority.
Does majority determine truth? Not necessarily. Maybe yes, maybe no. In the set, so let's call it Sefer Torah A, B, C. In A, it was written Ma'on. In B and C, it was written Ma'ona. Then the Talmud says, there was another problem. In one Sefer Torah, we'll call it C, was written the word Za'atute. And in two others, we'll call it A and C or something, it was written Na'are. How do you determine? Again, what happened was that there were three instances where the Sifrei Torah were different, and they didn't match up. Meaning in the first case, it was A and C. In the second case, it was B and A. And in the third case, it was B and C. And so what came out of this is what we call a polyglot text. A text that never existed. It was not A, and it was not B, and it was C. It was a text that was created by halacha. It was you understand, right? Everybody got that? It was a case where, when it came to deciding questions of authenticity, which is the right girsa, Chazal had to make determinations. They didn't have Ruach HaKodesh. They didn't have any more prophecy. They couldn't ask a prophet. They decided based on the rules of robe, of majority. Now to decide that is to, in effect, create a text that never existed before, at least in front of you. And yet that's the text that becomes Kadosh, because the rabbis say, God gave us the Torah, lo b'shamayim hi, and they gave us the right and the responsibility to determine in the real world in which we are in, how the text will read. Hopefully we got it right, but maybe we got it wrong, and it doesn't matter. Because that's the text that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us authority through the rabbis to determine is the Mikudash text. Now you can say this in one of two ways. You could say it in a more mystical way, or you can say it in a less mystical way, a Litvak way. You could say it in a mystical way and say that God is Siyata Dishmaya, His hand is guiding the rabbis in what they're doing, and they end up getting the right thing, and even if they get the wrong thing, it's for a certain purpose. That's one way to say it. You can also say it in a more rationalistic Litvak way and say, it doesn't really matter. This is the rules of evidence. This is the way the legal system works. This is what God said, and that's it. I don't care that this is not exactly the Torah in these small details that Moshe Rabbeinu got. I don't care because I have to live with the Torah in the real world. And the Torah in the real world is this Torah with these little changes. Radak, if you look on the source on the right side, Radak, the famous Rav David Kimchi, from the Kimchi family, Radak in his introduction to Yehoshua, Sefer Yehoshua, describes the phenomenon of Kri and Ketiv, right? Anyone who's ever leaned or read always is very troubled. What's Kri and Ketiv? Why does it say he with a vav? When it should be who? Why does it say this? Why does it say that? Sometimes they're minor, sometimes they're major distinctions between the way it's written and the way it's pronounced orally. What's the difference between Kri and Ketiv? So Radak has a theory. So take a look at the Radak. About 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down. Gam echtov, last word on the line. Gam echtov tam katuv ukri, or k'tiv and kri. V'katuv v'lo kri, v'kri v'lo katuv. Kasher uchal latet tam l'shnehem kol echad. I'll try to give an explanation for the rationale behind each reading. He's basing himself on the Masechet Sofrim. In the original exile from Eretz Yisrael in 597 and 586, many of the early Svarim were lost and messed up. And those who knew exactly the correct transmission died. And the men of the great assembly who restored the Torah to its glory, they found debates amongst the readings, the variant readings. And they always decided, they followed the rov. And in a place where they were not sure, katvu ha'echad v'lo nakdu, o katvu mibachutz v'lo katvu mibifnim, v'chein katvu b'derech acher mibifnim, b'derech acher mibachutz. He says, kri and k'tiv is the remnants of the inability of the rabbis to determine what was the correct reading. There were, when you had 50 manuscripts saying one way and 10 saying another way, so you determine based on 50. But when you don't, when you have 50 and 49, or 50 and 50, where it's kind of even, then the rabbis left it in place. Because they weren't sure which is the correct reading and which is the correct spelling. And so they said, both. We don't know for sure. This is a fascinating theory. It's based on the Masechet Sofrim. But it shows you in traditional sources the reality of the fact that maybe we don't get it right. And it's okay. We still keep Shabbos. And we still keep kosher. And we still put on tefillin. And we still are nice Jews. And we don't become apikorsim. And the world continues. A nice example that's always quoted in this discussion is Rashi and the Sifsei Chachamim, the famous Vav of the Sifsei Chachamim. Again, this is small things, but it's just shocking. I don't think they often teach this in a day school context. In Parshas Truma, at the end of Sheni, the Pasuk says, excuse me, Es kol asher atzaveh, O Schael ben Israel, you will do everything that I command you when you build the Mishkan. Rashi's Sefer Torah had a Vav. Ve'es. So take a look at the Rashi I cited for you. Ve'es kol asher atzaveh O Schael ben Israel. Harei Vav zu yitera. This Vav is extra. Utefela. It's totally insignificant. It's not there as part of the essential word. Ukamo harbe b'mikra. Ve'ko tiftor. So Rashi says, even though it has a vav, read it as if it's without a vav. Says the Sifsei Chachamim right up there. Afal pi she'ein k'tiv ve'es bevav, b'sefer Torah shel Rashi haya katuv bevav. What does that mean? In the Sefer Torah, Sifsei Chachamim, and we, it doesn't have a vav. In the Sefer Torah of Rashi, it did have a vav. What does that mean? I want to tell you what that means. That means if we went to France and discovered the Sefer Torah of Rashi, Rabban Shel Kol Beis Yisrael, Parshan Data, the greatest commentary who ever lived, and it had an autograph on it that said this was written by Rashi in Troy or in Worms, and it went to Sotheby's, and it was, you know, in that, and it was $1 million, and you brought it into my shul, I would puzzle it. It would be puzzled to read on Shabbos. And you'd have to take it out and put a gartel around it, and you'd have to take out a whole new Torah, and you'd have the whole machlokas, do I start from this Ali or that Ali, and all the complicated Mishnah Brura, because it's not kosher. It's not kosher.
Rashi's frummer than me and everybody here put together. And yet his Sefer Torah is not kosher. Because that's not the way the halachic process works. The halachic process is not about absolute truth of what was the actual Sefer Torah that Rashi read or that Moshe Rabbeinu read. It's about the Sefer Torah that Jewish tradition has consecrated to us. And in every generation, the Chachamim, up until the age of printing, when basically this all ended, because once you have the age of printing, basically, you can basically teach kids and sofrim exactly the consonantal text exactly as you want it from now on. You don't have to, you're not sitting in Italy with 10 manuscripts and 30 sofrim, etc. You can have a kind of uniform thing. So today you don't find too much difference between chumashim. But in the time of Rashi and the Baal HaMa'or and the Rambam and everybody else, there were hundreds of differences, not just three like there are today between Sfardim and Ashkenazim, Petsua Daka. There were hundreds of differences in the Sefer Torah that they read on Shabbos. And it didn't matter. And the Rishonim were all aware of it, and the Rishonim all knew about it. And the world continued. Because they understood that even if they had gotten a perfect, pristine Torah from heaven, through the vicissitudes of life and history, things had gotten messed up. And the world had to go on. And, you know, the Radak and the Masechet Sofrim who say that you determine based on Rov is one approach. There are others who say that you determine based on the best manuscripts that you have. For example, Maimonides, and that's why I'm coming back to the Rambam, Maimonides in Hilchot Sefer Torah makes a big deal, I'm sorry I didn't Xerox it, about the fact how so many of the Sifrei Torah are messed up. When it comes to the Petuchot and the Stumot. When it comes to the question of when you write a Sefer Torah, how much space do you leave between the end of a line and the beginning of the new line or the new section? The Petuchot and the Stumot. And Maimonides talks about how he saw such a balagan in the Sifrei Torah. And therefore he's decided that he's going to rely on the Sefer Torah of Ben Asher, the Aleppo Codex. Sefer HaYadua, the well-known book that is well-known as the most authentic. Notice the Rambam does not use the Rove model. He uses a different model to try to authenticate the best text and the best Sefer Torah that you can get. So the Rambam knew very well that in his days there were hundreds of small debates amongst the Sifrei Torah. So why does the Rambam...
It's better because in the letter he says that the reason it's the best is because the person who was doing it kept on correcting it.
Exactly. Exactly. And so the Rambam knew as well as anybody else, Ashkenazi Rishonim, Sephardi Rishonim, and the Rishonim, again, as I said, there's an amazing tshuva of the Rashba. The Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, who writes about the fact that what do you do when you, the Sofrim asked him, what do you do when you have psukim that you have to write, and in the Gemara, they make drushot on the psukim, which are different from the tradition that the Sofrim have how to write it. What do you do? Do you follow the tradition of the Sofrim? Or do you follow the drushot of the Gemara? For example, the Gemara sometimes says, like the beginning of Masechet Sanhedrin, the Gemara says about kranot, or how do we know that a sukkah has three walls or 2 1/4 walls, and it darshens because it's missing a vav, or it adds a vav, and in the tradition of the Sofrim, says the Rashba, they had it that was what with a vav or without a vav. Who do you follow? Do you follow the Gemara? Or do you follow the tradition of the Masoretes? And the Rashba says, you follow the tradition of the Masoretes. They had the authentic tradition, even though it's against the Gemara. That means in Bavel, the Talmud, we're all Talmudic Jews. And yet the consonantal text of our Bible that we read on Shabbos is many, many places different. There's a famous Rabbi Kiva Eiger in Shabbos Daf Nun Hei where he lists, you know, dozens of examples where the Talmud, the drashot of the Talmud are different than the received tradition of the Sofrim of how to read a Sefer Torah.
And so that's the reality. And that was the reality in Babel, it was the reality in Provence, it was the reality in France and Germany, up until the age of printing. Everybody knew it. All the Chachamim knew it. And nobody, and the Rambam knew it also. So if we go back to the Rambam, what's the Rambam really saying? What's the Rambam really saying? So, if you look at the last page I gave out, a little English citation from a great Rosh Yeshiva. His name was Rav Shmuel Yaakov Weinberg. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael, of Yeshiva Ner Yisrael, not in Canada, but in where Ner Yisrael started, in Baltimore. I'm sorry, he was here too? Oh, I didn't know. I'm sorry. So Rav Weinberg used to give lectures in to Balabatim on the Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Rambam. And when he gets to the eighth principle, he talks about all these sources. He's a very honest man, great Rosh Yeshiva. So this is a quote from that book called about the, I don't remember the exact name. So this is what he writes. So if you don't like Natty Helfgott saying it, you know, Rabbi Weinberg says it. Because, you know, like the old joke, you know, it's not enough that the Torah says it or this says it. You have to quote a Gadol who says it, right? So here, you have to say, Rambam knew very well that these variations existed when he defined his principles. The words of Ani Mamin and the words of the Rambam, the entire Torah in our possession today must not be taken literally, implying that all the letters of the present Torah are the exact letters given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Rather, it should be understood in a general sense that the Torah we learn and live by is for all intents and purposes the same Torah that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Chad v'chalak, straight and direct. It's not that every single word is exactly the same, but it's for all intents and purposes. It's like, you know, it's a little pregnant, meaning it's a little, the Rambam is using hyperbole here. Now, why does the Rambam use hyperbole? So here I would suggest something that many scholars of the Rambam have suggested, Professor Arthur Hyman, Professor Mark Shapiro, who's spoken, I know, here in Toronto, who's always exciting and fun. So it seems very clear that when the Rambam chose to formulate his principles, even though it had never been done before, part of the reason he did it was as a polemic against Christian and Muslim theology that potentially could make inroads in Jewish circles. One of the major, and that's of course why, for example, the Rambam emphasizes certain principles over others, and he doesn't mention some which he himself believed were very critical, but he doesn't mention them in the Yud Gimel Ikrim. And we know that one of the classical arguments that Islam and Judaism, medieval Judaism and Islam, fought around was the text of the Torah. Medieval Islam very strongly argued that the Jews had forged and changed the text of the Torah. For example, the idea that the Akedah was Yitzchak rather than Yishmael. It was really Yishmael who was the beloved son of Abraham. That there had been tinkering with the text, because of course, for Islam, Moses is a prophet, and the Torah is scripture on some level. So one of the strong arguments, one of the classic ta'anot of Islam to Judaism was that we had forged or changed the text of the Torah. And part of the very strong rhetoric of the Rambam here may be rooted in the attempt, he's talking to simple Jews, he's not talking to fancy schmancy professors. The Yud Gimel Ikrim is written for the masses. It wasn't written. The Moreh HaNevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, was written for the philosophers. But for the average Jew, you're not going to get into these fine distinctions. 98% of the Torah is exactly what God gave, but 2% is different. Oh, if 2% are different, maybe 6% can be different, maybe 20%, maybe the Christians or maybe the Muslims are right. So the Maimonides makes kind of an absolute statement to the whole world, to all Jews, to all simple Jews, and say, Chad v'chalak, the Torah text that we have today is exactly the Torah text that Hashem gave to Moshe. without getting into the niceties about whether every Kriyin Ktiv is exactly what Moshe gave, because it's not on the agenda here. That's not the agenda of the Rambam. And so I think that's the most convincing, cogent explanation for why the Rambam chooses to use such strong hyperbole and such strong rhetoric when it comes to the questions of the consonantal text of the Torah. Now, the truth is that, first of all, does anyone have any questions at this point before I come to my final point? Yes. And maybe he had the Karaim in mind. Correct. We can talk about all kinds of polemics, but the language is so to speak, over the top and goes beyond what the Talmud says. The Talmudic source focuses on the divine authorship and source of the Torah. It doesn't focus on the fact that every single word that we have today is exactly the same. And Maimonides, by bringing that to the fore and making it one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, has really gone very far beyond, and part of it may be motivated by this polemical agenda. Yes, other questions?
Billy Hebraic, a Stuttgartensia.
Exactly. There's like 500 different changes on any page. Well, how do they defend that?
I assume they haven't bought those Bibles yet. Maybe you want to send them a copy.
And who they exist.
I'm being facetious, but they, either one of two, I'm very serious now, either they don't know, or they've chosen to make a polemical stand, just as the Rambam did. They feel, for their oilam, that these kind of nuances are a little bit too dicey, and they don't know where it will lead. The classic slippery slope argument. I don't agree with it, but I understand where they come from. But it's not just in this. What about in 20 other thousand things that sometimes great rabbis say things which are not exactly what reflects the range of positions within the tradition. You've never encountered that?
No, not at all. What I'm saying is, this is not defensible anymore in light of a book that's been around for 100 years.
Forget a book, the Gemara. In light of the Gemara, it's indefensible. In light of the Radak, it's indefensible. But they have chosen, they believe that their people are not going to read the Radak, or maybe won't read the Gemara. It's harder now because you have Art Scroll. So people are going to read Gemaras and do Daf Yomi. It's a kind of challenge. People actually will learn some Gemaras that they're a little problematic, a little pashut. I'm being facetious, but look, people have chosen to, you know, to put a line in the sand because they believe educationally, communally, this is where they have to. And you know, in a certain sense, they'll say we're taking our cue from the Rambam. The Rambam said you have to teach, you know, the women and the children and the masses X, Y, Z, and you keep the truth, you know. You know, the Hamaskil Yidom, kind of. You know, the one who really knows. You keep that for, you know, behind closed doors, you know. But look, you know, there was always that approach within, always a tension within the tradition about how, you know, how forthcoming you should be about the more, you know, the more edgy kind of issues that might lead. And, of course, the fact that we have the Reform and Conservative movement and all that has affected people as well. It's different when you're sitting in 12th century Spain and saying something like, you know, part of the Torah was not written by Moshe, it was written by the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and it's a little portion here, a little portion there, or in Ashkenaz in the 1300s, when as opposed to sitting in, you know, in the middle of Germany in the 1880s when Orthodoxy is on the defensive and et cetera, et cetera. So I, you know, there's certain things that Hirsch says and others say, you know, so I understand where they're coming from, and you have to have a historical sense of where people are working off of. It doesn't change, I think, the fact that today, you know, we live after. We certainly, as modern Orthodox Jews, we can't live with our head in the sand. And it's not productive, and it doesn't do anything for anybody, and they're going to discover it anyway with the internet. You can find 100,000, you know, hits about this issue anyway, about is the Torah that we gave, God had signed exactly the same Torah, and they'll quote you all the sources anyway. So some kid, some bright kid who went to York or to Harvard or to Princeton, he's going to say, "Oh, you Rebbe, you were a liar. You didn't tell me the truth." That's not productive. So I hope the Rebbe doesn't have to answer, because the Rebbe. Now again, this is not necessarily what you have to teach in fourth grade, but it doesn't. But certainly, if it comes up, you have to be matter of fact about it. You know, that's also another thing. We make such a big hoo-ha. It's not a big hoo-ha. The Rashba still went being on the Rashba the next day that he knew that the Gemara was not the same as his Torah text. Then what happens? Nothing happens. We're still frum. We still daven. We still, and everything can work out. Shalom al Yisrael. We don't have to make a big hoo-ha about everything. Yes?
You're implying that we don't have to make a big, not just implying, you're saying we don't have to make a big hoo-ha. But think about how what you're saying impacts the act of reading the pasuk, reading the text, and trying to engage with it. Okay? If you accept this lower biblical criticism, as you said, you're reading the pasuk, there's a strange grammatical form, there's a I don't know what. And you can just turn to your return page and shrug and say, scribal error.
Maybe.
I mean, what happens to the breaking the head and the creative interpretation of the Torah is written in such an odd way? There must be something behind it, to the Shivim Panim. If you go, you mentioned in like 1 second the mystical route that says the Torah came down to us in this way because somehow God guides it. And so there is a certain design behind the fact that this particular girsah came into our hands. If you don't take that route, then what's to stop you every second passage shrugging and going scribal error, and then your religious activity is one of scribal erroring instead of the
Tzara. So first of all, the question is, number one, what kinds of changes are we talking about? Are they small or much? Most of them are small. They don't really affect whether it's plene or it's, you know, whether it's a vav or it's not a vav. Right? So it doesn't really get to that kind of religious meaning issue that you're talking about. But in those areas where it does, in Hachanami, I think you have to have a different kind of theology, a different kind of approach. Either you take that more mystical approach that tries to really figure out what, you know, God intended through the hands of human beings and the vicissitudes of history to work out, and that's a very legitimate approach to the best of your ability. Or you say, I'm never going to be able to recover the pristine original reading. I have to deal with the reading that history and halacha has bequeathed to me. And that's the reading that has significance for me, because I live within the halachic system. Just as I said last night, just as 24 books are holy because Chazal told me they're holy, even though there were thousands of other books written at the same time. But Chazal said the book of Esther is somehow important, but the book of Ben Sira is not important, even though Ben Sira might be frumer in certain things than Esther. And I have to try to understand what is the meaning religiously, theologically for me. So too, I have to try to understand that this is what, if I believe that the divine system kind of pulled back, tzimtzum, and said, now you, Chazal, and human beings are going to be the custodians of this text. So I live within that system, and I try to make meaning. Now, that, and to the great extent, that's, when we talk about biblical lower biblical criticism, it has no effect on the halacha in the sense that the halacha works in its own categories. Meaning, lower biblical criticism may think that the principle of rove is a silly way of determining the best reading of what originally it was. And yet halacha may have its own canons and say, I don't really care what you think. We follow these canons of legal theory. And so the Sefer Torah that I use on Shabbos is never going to be subject necessarily, it's going to be subject to the canons of halacha. So
that's also mystical. You're still placing yourself.
Okay, fine. So then so the both are mystical.
100% rationalist. Because if it was, you could start to undermine it with rationalism.
Yeah, okay. It also gets into another discussion, which has to do with drashot, which I just touched on. I thought you were going to ask me a harder question, which is, what do you do with drashot that are based on psukim that are totally different than what we today have in our Sifrei Torah? So, I mentioned it in passing, but I didn't do a full unpacking of the issue. But the answer, I think, is tied to, again, one of two. Everything's always one of two. Either it points to the fact that drashot are not as literal as we think they are, that probably the rabbis had these halachot by tradition, and the drashot is much more of a hook than a real creative technique. And so the halacha doesn't rise and fall on this specific drasha or that specific drasha. Or you can be more radical and say, it doesn't matter. They darshan the text they had in front of them, and this now had force once it was accepted into the legal canon, irrespective of its genesis. And that can exist on its own. So again, you know, yes, Shalom, I'm sure you have a good question.
You haven't mentioned Tikkun Sofri in the nation of the scribes.
Correct.
You seem to have maybe a half dozen pieces of evidence.
So let's mention Tikkun Sofri. That it also supports, especially if you Tikkunei Sofrim as opposed to Kina HaKatuv, Tikkunei Sofrim seems to mean, like Professor Lieberman and others pointed out, seems to mean exactly what it means, that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola chose to consciously change certain words because they might be misinterpreted or were not theologically in line with what they thought. Correct. And, you know, that's definitely a very radical reading, but you find it in the Tanhuma and you find it in other places. And that's a very that's even farther reaching. Now, how far do you go with that is, of course, you know, modern discussions. Once you have all these precedents in the traditional sources, and that's why, remember, my talk, I made my life easy for myself, was all about traditional sources. But the question is, once you have these traditional sources, how much precedent is it to run farther? Are you allowed to go as far as Halev from a traditional? I mean, allowed. You can do whatever you want. You know, we live in a free country. But a kind of, you know, can you do what Halivni does, where he talks about, you know, he uses the Masechet Sofrim about not just that Ezra and the Anshei Knesset HaGdola fixed certain isolated, but they rewrote the entire Torah based with divine inspiration because they saw that so much of it had been lost. I mean, how far can you go with that? And do you turn the Torah into Divrei Hayamim, where Divrei Hayamim is this collection of different sources, and you know, so you have Halivni. So you know, how far do you go? So I'm not the posek of how far you can go. I'm you know, that's you'll ask other poskim about that, and Shalom, you won't ask. You'll ask yourself what you want to do. Okay. Yes. That's a very difficult question. I don't know anything about gematria. The only gematrias I know are the Balaturim, which I learned as a little kid. Because gematria always didn't sit well with me because you could always add a one if it didn't work. So that didn't sound too kosher in my eyes. So, yeah. Right. Why not? V'zot haTorah asher sam Moshe. This is the Torah. I don't understand. It's basically the Torah. I don't understand. If you, God forbid, went in for an operation, God forbid, and they had to replace your hip and your knee, you're still the same person, right? You're not the bionic, right? They didn't change 90% of you. So if they still have a little bit, it's still v'zot haTorah asher sam Moshe. Lifnei bnei Yisrael, pi Hashem, biyad Moshe. Have a wonderful afternoon.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.